Today we'll be continuing The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Chapter 17, The Pastor and His Parishioner, Part 1. Slowly, as the minister walked, he had almost gone by before Hester Prynne could gather voice enough to attract his observation. At length, she succeeded. "Arthur Dimmesdale," she said, faintly at first, then louder but hoarsely. "Arthur Dimmesdale!"
"Who speaks?" answered the minister.
Gathering himself quickly up, he stood more erect, like a man taken by surprise in a mood to which he was reluctant to have witnesses. Throwing his eyes anxiously in the direction of the voice, he indistinctly beheld a form under the trees, clad in garments so somber and so little relieved from the gray twilight, into which the clouded sky and the heavy foliage had darkened the noontide, that he knew not whether it were a woman or a shadow. It may be that his pathway through life was haunted thus by a specter that had stolen out from among his thoughts. He made a step nigher and discovered the scarlet letter.
"Hester? Hester Prynne?" said he. "Is it thou? Art thou in life?"
"Even so," she answered. "In such life as has been mine these 7 years past. And thou, Arthur Dimmesdale, dost thou yet live?" It was no wonder that they thus questioned one another's actual and bodily existence, and even doubted of their own. So strangely did they meet in the dim wood, that it was like the first encounter in the world beyond the grave, of two spirits who had been intimately connected in their former life, but now stood coldly shuddering in mutual dread, as not yet familiar with their state, nor wanted to the companionship of disembodied beings. Each a ghost, and awe-stricken at the other ghost. They were awe-stricken likewise at themselves, because the crisis flung back to them their consciousness, and revealed to each heart its history and experience, as life never does, except at such breathless epochs. The soul beheld its features in the mirror of the passing moment. It was with fear, and tremulously, and as it were by a slow, reluctant necessity, that Arthur Dimmesdale put forth his hand, chill as death, and touched the chill hand of Hester Prynne. The grasp, cold as it was, took away what was dreariest in the interview. They now felt themselves, at least, inhabitants of the same sphere. Without a word more spoken, neither he nor she assuming the guidance, but with an unexpressed consent, they glided back into the shadow of the woods, whence Hester had emerged, and sat down on the heap of moss where she and Pearl had before been sitting. When they found voice to speak, it was, at first, only to utter remarks and inquiries such as any two acquaintance might have made about the gloomy sky, the threatening storm, and, next, the health of each. Thus they went onward, not boldly, but step by step, into the themes that were brooding deepest in their hearts. So long estranged by fate and circumstances, they needed something slight and casual to run before and throw open the doors of intercourse, so that their real thoughts might be led across the threshold. After a while, the minister fixed his eyes on Hester Prynne's.
"Hester," said he, "hast thou found peace?"
She smiled drearily, looking down upon her bosom. "Hast thou?" she asked.
"None. Nothing but despair," he answered. "What else could I look for, being what I am, in leading such a life as mine? Were I an atheist, a man devoid of conscience, a wretch with coarse and brutal instincts, I might have found peace long ere now. Nay, I never should have lost it. But as matters stand with my soul, whatever of good capacity there originally was in me, all of God's gifts that were the choicest have become the minister's spiritual torment. Hester, I am most miserable."
"The people reverence thee," said Hester, "and surely thou workest good among them. Doth thou bring thee no comfort?"
"More misery, Hester, only the more misery," answered the clergyman with a bitter smile. "As concerns the good which I may appear to do, I have no faith in it. It must needs be a delusion. What can a ruined soul like mine effect towards the redemption of other souls, or a polluted soul towards their purification? And as for the people's reverence, would that it were turned to scorn and hatred. Canst thou deem it, Hester, a consolation that I must stand up in my pulpit and meet so many eyes turned upward to my face as if the light of heaven were beaming from it? Must see my flock hungry for the truth and listening to my words as if a tongue of Pentecost were speaking? and then look inward and discern the black reality of what they idolize. I have laughed, in bitterness and agony of heart, at the contrast between what I seem and what I am, and Satan laughs at it. "You wrong yourself in this," said Hester gently. "You have deeply and sorely repented. Your sin is left behind you in the days long past. Your present life is not less holy, in very truth, than it seems in people's eyes. Is there no reality in the penitence thus sealed and witnessed by good works? And wherefore should it not bring you peace?" "No, Hester, no," replied the clergyman. "There is no substance in it. It is cold and dead and can do nothing for me. Of penance, I have had enough. Of penitence, there has been none. Else I should long ago have thrown off these garments of mock holiness and have shown myself to mankind as they will see me at the judgment seat." "Happy are you, Hester, that wear the scarlet letter openly upon your bosom. Mine burns in secret. Thou little knowest what a relief it is, after the torment of a 7 years' cheat, to look into an eye that recognizes me for what I am. Had I one friend, or were it my worst enemy, to whom, when sickened with the praises of all other men, I could daily betake myself, and be known as the vilest of all sinners, methinks my soul might keep itself alive thereby. Even thus much of truth would save me, but now it is all falsehood, all emptiness, all death."
Hester Prynne looked into his face, but hesitated to speak. Yet uttering his long-restrained emotions so vehemently as he did, his words were offered her the very point of circumstances in which to interpose what she came to say. She conquered her fears and spoke. "Such a friend as thou hast even now wished for," said she, "with whom to weep over thy sin, thou hast in me, the partner of it." Again she hesitated, but brought out the words with an effort. "Thou hast long had such an enemy, and dwellest with him under the same roof." The minister started to his feet, gasping for breath and clutching at his heart, as if he would have torn it out of his bosom.
"Ha! What sayest thou?" cried he. "An enemy, and under mine own roof. What mean you?"
Hester Prynne was now fully sensible of the deep injury for which she was responsible to this unhappy man, in permitting him to lie for so many years, or indeed, for a single moment, at the mercy of one whose purposes could not be other than malevolent. The very contiguity of his enemy, beneath whatever mask the latter might conceal himself, was enough to disturb the magnetic sphere of a being so sensitive as Arthur Dimmesdale. There had been a period when Hester was less alive to this consideration, or perhaps in the misanthropy of her own trouble. She left the minister to bear what she might picture to herself as a more tolerable doom. But of late, since the night of his vigil, all her sympathies towards him had been both softened and invigorated. She now read his heart more accurately. She doubted not that the continual presence of Roger Chillingworth, the secret poison of his malignity, infected all the air about him, and his authorized interference as a physician with the minister's physical and spiritual infirmities, that these bad opportunities had been turned to a cruel purpose. By means of them, the sufferer's conscience had been kept in an irritated state, the tendency of which was not to cure by wholesome pain, but to disorganize and corrupt his spiritual being. Its result on earth could hardly fail to be insanity. And hereafter, that eternal alienation from the good and true, of which madness is perhaps the earthly type. Such was the ruin to which she had brought the man once. Nay, why should we not speak it? Still so passionately loved, Hester felt that the sacrifice of the clergyman's good name and death itself, as she had already told Roger Chillingworth, would have been infinitely preferable to the alternative which she had taken upon herself to choose. And now, rather than have had this grievous wrong to confess, she would gladly have lain down on the forest leaves and died there at Arthur Dimmesdale's feet. Thank you for joining Bite at a Time Books today, while we read a bite of one of your favorite classics. Again, my name is Bree Carlisle, and I hope you come back tomorrow for the next bite of The Scarlet Letter.